What Does Law Mean, Mumu? The podcast series. Hello, this is Pauline Maranin here, continuing on this podcast series where we discuss some of the connected themes or look a little bit deeply into some of the subjects discussed in the chapters of the little book, What Does Law Mean, Mumu, that I wrote as an introduction to legal principles, things about the law for young people. In this podcast, we're going to look at chapter 12, where we discussed data protection, social media and politics. We touched on the Nobel Prize and the voices of poets in sharing wisdom. So we actually referred to Seamus Heaney again in this part of the book for his reference to "We all live on the conveyor belt of our generation," that encouraged thought about all of the young people in this group, the learners, the fact that they were on a different conveyor belt, and that their conveyor belt in many respects is dominated by technology and social media. The hope was expressed then and is still that in the future their lives would not be as controlled by social media as they are now, and that it will be for them, for that generation, to balance that relationship. Living through a very dramatic period of our history in 2018 when this book was written, and if it was true then, it's certainly true now. But at that time, looking back over 2 years, we'd had a number of major things happening. They're coming up to 4-year anniversaries soon. And that was the election in America for a new president. President Donald Trump was elected in 2016. And also in that year, there was a referendum held in the United Kingdom as to whether they would remain in the European Union. And as a result of that referendum, which was to leave, even though it was not by a large majority, the path was set for the exit from a relationship which gave rise to many challenges and difficulties in trying to work out how the United Kingdom would actually exit from a relationship it had been in for so many years, not only from an economic and trade point of view, but also from all the legal and regulatory connections that had been drawn up and sewn into a connecting tapestry of working relationships over the last 40 years or so. There had been a lot of concern raised at the time, not only of the election of President Trump in America, but then at the time of the referendum in the United Kingdom, about the role that media platforms, social media platforms such as Facebook, had had in the way people had been voting. Suggestions had been made that were later verified that a major challenge to democracy really was occurring as we know it, when the stories emerged about companies who carried out research about having managed to gain access to data which was provided by Facebook on Facebook account holders. There were suggestions in the United States that some companies had harvested personal data to take information that is part of somebody's personal data, gather it together to form a view of what kind of person I am, my profile, and then being able to assess what kind of person I would be by the subjects I'm interested in, what I like to do, what books and articles I read, and ultimately to form the decision that I'm a so-and-so type of person and therefore likely to vote in a certain way or be a middle ground person or a don't know. That means that if they're campaigning for a referendum or for a presidential or governmental election, they know a lot about where to pitch their advertising and where to spend more of their campaign budget and time making their case attractive to the people they think might vote for them. Now, if all these stories that we were hearing were true and if companies like Facebook were providing data about individuals to companies to use that information to find out where they should concentrate their work or where they should target their campaign to get people who would be amenable to their persuasion to vote for whatever it was they wanted them to vote for, then what the implications of this are quite sinister. Really, if we talk about this further, consider the great sums of money involved where information that is personal and private about me becomes a subject of a bargain between people who are using that information for certain gains. Well, challenge me if you will, but I call that bullying on a grand scale. Let us use the word openly. These people are engaged in exploitation and bullying. So, at around the time when I was drawing up this book in 2018, There was news coming out that a report in the United Kingdom had shown that social media was, quote, the most dangerous factor driving harassment and intimidation of political candidates. It was reported that some members of parliament had been warning at that time in 2018 about the extent of interference in the elections, claiming that the spread of fake news and data manipulation was throwing the country into a democratic crisis. Now, perhaps this went out of the spotlight as all of the difficulties about Brexit took over, but in the intervening 2 years, that problem hasn't gone away, but maybe has just been dimmed a little by other more serious matters which have taken the daily news highlight, not to mention the dominance of a pandemic which threatens the survival of so many of us. I mention all of this because it's true that social media platforms are now being seen as a norm in the way of life of young people and the people who I will consider to be the readers of this book. So it's very important that your generation takes a very objective, hard, cold view of these developments. You must understand what the dangers and risks are so that any engagement that you have with these social media platforms is an informed one and that you know what the implications are and what the threats are both to your privacy and to your precious democracy and freedom. So it's important at this time to digest what the implications are now in the medium term and the long term. If this trend is not stopped with proper regulation and legislation, we need these valuable checks and balances. We need ways of ensuring that our privacy and our rights to our own self-determination are not taken away by people who are really attempting to hold power through influence and bully the electorate into voting for them when they have obtained information about those people through illicit means. Now, we would cast a comparison there to the way that elections are normally run, where people would campaign on the basis of going from door to door, putting up posters, but actually having a relationship, an interface, standing at bus stops, standing at railway stations, handing out leaflets, and campaigning for yourself when people have an opportunity of stopping and talking to you or having a word with you and they can see you. At least you know that somebody is facing you directly if they're asking you for the votes. If we're coming up to any kind of a significant election, it's very important that those elections are overseen by an electoral commission to ensure that the information that's being put out is fair, balanced and accurate. But there are differences between somebody knocking on your door or speaking to you personally and this rather underhand way of procuring information from you through social media. And you don't have an opportunity of speaking back. You don't know when and how they are discerning what kind of a voter you are. And it's all done in a very clandestine, dark way, which I would find very threatening. I wouldn't like it to come across that this is just my impression of the bleak picture, because there are others who have made this their chosen study. I would refer in particular to a well-respected academic based in the United States who's written extensively on these subjects. Sherry Turkel is her name. She's professor of the social studies of science and technology at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT. Her area of interest and research looks at how computers are not tools so much as part of our social and psychological lives now. And so she focuses on the psychology of human relationship with technology, particularly in the realm of how people relate to one another. She's written several books, one called Alone Together, another called Life on the Screen. She's given many TED Talks, which are very interesting and engaging. One she gave in a series was called Connected but Alone, which is one of the themes that she studies on a continuing basis. She examines how flight from conversation, undermines our relationships, our creativity, and our productivity, and why reclaiming face-to-face conversation can help us to regain lost ground. In a nutshell, she will say that we live in a technological universe in which we're always communicating, and yet we have somehow sacrificed conversation for mere connection. Some of her observations center on the idea that developing technology seems to promise closeness. She will even say that sometimes it delivers on that, but that much of our modern lives leaves us less connected with people and much more connected with simulations of them. She has also spent a lot of time discussing the problems that arise when children pose as adults online, and in many respects we know that these problems are presenting difficulties in our world every day. This is a subject I think we should return to many times. I would also add to Sherry Turkle's theory about the connectedness being with simulations of people through social media to say that it also contributes to groupthink. People are being lulled into and tutored into and drawn into thinking the same way because on these platforms, at the same time, with the press of a button, several people will say the same things or agree or put out an idea, and so the crowd follows or the crowd disagrees, but it's all done to a sort of a preordained pattern, and it's done with a click, with a thumbs up or a thumbs down or a smiley face, or, Lord preserve us, little love hearts back and forth to denote approval and support. And so not only is that simulation of a person, as Sherry Turkle proposes, but it also, I believe and would suggest, contributes to groupthink and, I hope not, but groupthink and group feeling go together. So she's made that the centre of her research and writing. They are providing a gloomy prospect if what she's proposing is actually a true reflection of where we're going. The question is, at what speed are we going? And when you consider the controversy that is raging just at this moment, in the beginning of 2020 or halfway through, about Twitter and the debate it was having with the President of the United States and the threat that he has made in writing up an executive order in which he would be proposing to make social media platforms responsible for what is written on them. Because up until this time, they have been, unlike other publishers, unlike publishers of books, they haven't been held responsible for what's written on their platforms. You remember we were discussing libel a few chapters back and discussing how the ultimate printer and the publisher and even the person who sells the book would be liable for the libel in the book if there were a claim. But here now there is a threat to change and alter the relationship that the social media platforms have had with the public up until now. We talked a little bit about the Nobel Prize and that Seamus Heaney, one of the greatest poets of the last generation really, was granted the Nobel Prize for Literature by the Swedish Academy. It's a prize given to authors for outstanding contributions in the field of literature. And in the course of this book, I haven't mentioned it a lot in the podcast, but one of the themes of the book is that the young people who form this inquisitive group, who give rise to the conversations in the course of a number of trips, were going to commit themselves to a pen friend project with someone they'd become close to over a 3-month period, staying in their house, called Verity, who was returning to France to study law. And the whole notion had arisen that they would get her to write to them and tell them about the progress in her law studies and how she was finding it and some subjects that arose in the course of her studies, and that they in turn, by finding out a little about law nearer to home, would be able to put questions to her and become involved in an exchange of ideas and information about how things are done differently in the courts in the French system as opposed to in the common law system. And this could provide for very good exchange of information, but also some interesting reason to study further and look at the difference. And in this instance, of course, the first Nobel Prize for Literature was awarded in 1901 to a person called Sully Prudhomme. This was a pseudonym, which was for his full name, was René François Armand. And although he was called René François Armand Prudhomme, he called himself Sully. We'll never know why, but that was his own name. So Seamus Heaney was born in 1939, just at the outbreak of the Second World War, at a family farmhouse in Northern Ireland, and was the first boy, first child of 9 children. It's amazing to think of people in those days living on the earnings of a farm and how they would bring up and feed, not to mention nourish and educate 9 children. It is very difficult for us to think in terms of being able to find the resources to do so. But all of the family did very well, and they were all given fine educations and they all excelled in their lives in different ways. But just imagine preparing a meal for 11 people every day, including the parents. He wrote a poem about his mother, to whom he was absolutely devoted. He made no secret of that. A very special relationship with her. And the poem was about helping his mother peel the potatoes in readiness for a meal. And he was excited because this was a rare opportunity for him to be with his mother when all the others were away. And there was a furtiveness to that, that he was with her on her own. And they'd all gone to church. And so the poem is called When All the Others Were Away at Mass. When all the others were away at Mass, I was all hers as we peeled potatoes. They broke the silence, let fall one by one, like solder weeping off the soldering iron. Cold comforts set between us, things to share, gleaning in a bucket of clean water, and again let fall. Little pleasant splashes from each other's work would bring us to our senses. Beautiful part of the poem. The poem goes on to be rather sad later, where the other verse talks about the day that his mother was dying. It is interesting to look back on the celebration of Seamus Heaney, who passed away in 2013, and there is a beautiful exhibition of his works in Dublin, which I believe is well worth a view. In fact, it was one of the promises at the end of the book with the young people that when we regathered and regrouped for further discussions, we would include a visit to that exhibition as part of our tour and our walk and talk, during which we discuss so many interesting topics and during which time, I hope, a little information about how the law works and how it helps to preserve our democratic processes was shared and imparted to the group of young people, my learners, for the time that I spent with them. Thank you very much. I look forward to talking to you again and exploring some of the other topics in the remaining chapters.